Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer. Inside the evidence, behind the headlines, from someone who's been there. Here now, Jennifer Coffendaffer.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. I first of all want to thank you all for being here. We had a slight delay in time starting at 5:30 instead of 5. I hope everyone received that notification about the change of time. We are so fortunate today to welcome to the stage Dr. Carmela Upright. She is an amazing scholar, a philosopher, it's really studied Ivy League, currently is a professor at Furman, also a professor at the University of South Carolina, just an amazing scholar when it comes to neuropsychiatry, and really just the study of humans. So this is going to be really interesting. One of her cases that she's been most devoted to studying, if you will, is the Adelson case, and always want to bring to the stage and to the audience people who really understand the subject matter, people who have watched the trial, people who have been involved and invested in this case really since 2014. Really quickly, we're going to be talking about the Donna Adelson trial, but specifically talking about Donna Adelson and Wendy Adelson. As many of you know, Dan Markell was murdered in 2014. He was in his garage, in his vehicle. There were two hitmen that in 2016 were arrested. They were ultimately tried and convicted, along with a co-conspirator, Meg Nanabaugh, who was associated girlfriend with Charlie Adelson, the son of Donna Adelson, who's on trial. He's already had his trial. He's also been convicted of this big conspiracy, essentially to kill Dan Markell, who was in this custody battle over children with his wife, and estranged wife, I should say, Wendy Adelson. That's the down and dirty. It's really was just all about these kids. And Donna Adelson has been on trial, and many of us have been watching it. So without further ado, I want to bring Dr. Carmela Upright to the stage.
Hello. Hello.
How are you doing? We got the mic problem worked out. We're all good.
Yes. Good, good. Yeah, excited to talk about the case. I've been following it since probably 2015. So this has been going on for 11 years, and I became interested in probably a year in.
Oh, that's great. Great. I'm glad you kind of dialed down to where your involvement began. So thank you so much. Listen, I have a lot of questions regarding Donna Adelson. I'm going to put her up on the screen here. So for anybody who doesn't know her, and believe me, when she was younger, she was actually quite a looker. But I think everything that's transpired beyond age, she's looking pretty rough over ever since she's been arrested, certainly. Can you talk to us a little bit about just Donna Adelson as a whole? Give us just your general reflection on her as a person and what you've seen.
So Donna Adelson, I actually think she probably looks a lot better than she does in court. I think a lot of this is a demonstration of I'm just a frail grandmother. So Donald Adelson is married to Harvey Adelson. They've been married for, I want to say, over 50 years at this point, supposedly very devoted. There are three children. Two of them testified in this case, and I hope we'll get a chance to talk about their testimony because it's absolutely fascinating. We're kind of watching this family deconstruct. She was originally educated as a I want to say kindergarten teacher, so definitely lower elementary school teacher. And then her husband is a very, very well-established dentist. He runs what's called the Adelson Institute, which he sold to his son. His son Charlie, the second born, who is now in prison for this crime. Donna had very close, and some would say overly close, relationships with her three children. So Rob is the oldest. Charlie, who is in prison, is the middle child. And Wendy Adelson is the baby, and they very much treat her like a baby. I think that's a very interesting question as well. And the idea was that, I don't think it's an idea. There's four people who are now in prison as a result of this case. And what happened, we know that what happened, because four people have been, convicted of this, is that she is now on trial for orchestrating the killing of her daughter Wendy's ex-husband, Danny Markell. And so Donna is, I think, part of the prosecution strategy, which I think is right after following this for 10 years, is that she's extremely controlling, that she is absolutely the matriarch of this family, and that her children fall into line for what she wants for them. And that is kind of deconstructing at this point. The idea of killing Danny Markell is to get the children to South Florida, which is where Donna and her husband Harvey and Charlie all live. They were up in Tallahassee, Florida, which is where Dan and Wendy both were teaching at the law school. They became divorced. Wendy applied for relocation to move her two children to the Miami area. She was denied relocation. And so the idea is they killed Danny Markell so that she could move the children to Miami. And that is precisely what happened. They moved the very next day after Danny was killed.
That's such a great summary, Doctor, because some of our viewers don't really know about this case. This was not a case that I closely followed on my Twitter or on YouTube compared to other cases. So I appreciate that more in-depth summary. I wanted to put up a picture here. This is who we're talking about, Dan, aka Danny Markell, a law professor, very distinguished, by the way. When I was doing my research on him for this piece, just so well liked, considered an innovator, one of those instructors that the students just gravitated to. I just couldn't find anything other than just glowing remarks and reviews regarding him. Has that been your
Absolutely brilliant. So I've read multiple legal articles that he published. He was extremely well published. He has two degrees from Harvard. His bachelor's degree was from Harvard. He then went on to, I believe it was Cambridge, I don't think it was Oxford, to get the equivalent of a master's degree in philosophy. So like me, he did study of philosophy. And then he went back to Harvard to get his law degree. He ended up mostly, the thought is that he ended up at Florida State, that he could probably be in the Ivy League. He could be a lot of places. And I think the intention was that eventually he would go back to an Ivy League school. It wasn't just well-respected, he was well-loved. He spent a lot of time mentoring other lawyers, mentoring young lawyers. He had something called the Prof's Blog. You have to remember that this was 2014. And he was well-known for reading multiple drafts of other younger legal scholars. So his own work is brilliantly written, very much an innovator. But he also was just a generous, generous scholar and mentor. It is very difficult to find anyone that has anything bad to say about Danny. And I'm calling him Danny. And actually, the defense attorney actually made a big deal out of this. I'm going to call him Danny because that's what everybody called him. I'm not being disrespectful. I'm going to call him Danny because it is really what his friends called him. There are multiple Facebook pages and other pages set up in honor of him. And everyone is following this case because Dan Markell was just a very beloved person.
That's a beautiful, really recitation of everything I've read about him. But you summed it up well. I'm glad you went over the extent of his education, because a lot of people may not know this, but I know everybody highly regards Harvard, but it literally is the hardest school to get into. It's yeah. It's like the lower part of 1%. It's so low.
Especially Harvard Law.
Yes. I have a friend who's there now. The daughter, actually, of one of my dearest friends is there, and it's such an accomplishment. But I'm glad you went over his education. And this begs the question: you have somebody like this, and that seemingly is not only a scholar but just a loved and beloved person. What in the world do you think led to this? You know, him being called Gibbers. Let's just call it.
Oh, God, let's go with Gibbers. Okay, so let me explain. Do you want me to explain Gibbers?
Yes, please.
So that is the nickname that was given to him by, I've lost you. I can't see you. So I'm just going to keep talking.
Yeah, it was go off. It's because I'm checking comments and then also adding some pictures. So sorry about that.
Okay. So he was called Danny by pretty much everyone that loved him, and also called Danny by his wife when they were married. After they were married and this very, very contentious divorce, her mother, Wendy Adelson's mother, and Donna Adelson, the person who is on trial, referred to him as Gibbers. It's interesting because Wendy has been asked about the name Gibbers multiple times on the stand. So she has testified in all of the cases, all four of them. And the prosecution has asked, why have you called him Gibbers? Is it insulting? And she always says, oh, no, it's not insulting. He was so intimidating and he was so emotionally abusive that I gave him this name so that I could sort of take some of the power away. And, you know, that way it wasn't as scary for me. In this trial, what she said is it was just a silly nickname. But everyone knows that it wasn't a silly nickname, that this was a way to diminish Danny Markell's power and to mock him, to treat him terribly. And the idea behind Gibbers, I believe, is he talked too much. He had flappy jaws. And, you know, it's hard to diminish Danny Markell. Danny Markell was very accomplished and, as I already said, very well loved. And so how do you do that? You attack him personally with nasty nicknames and pretty much anything else that you can throw at him. So that's where Gibbers came from. So I've lost you a bit. I think Gibbers is also really, really well represents the way in which Donna Adelson, the matriarch of this family, the mother of Wendy Adelson, they really felt like they couldn't have power over him. And you can see why that would be true. It would be intimidating. Wendy is also an attorney. She's an immigration attorney. She did not have a tenure track position at Florida State. Apparently she really just had a position because they wanted to keep Danny so much. And so Gibbers, I think, is one of the many representations of Donna Adelson. I think we know that Donna is the original person to give him that name. It's a representation of how controlling and how she wants the power. And it's very hard to get the power from someone like Danny. Even though he wasn't a mean or vicious person, he's an intimidating person.
You know, when I first heard that name, Gibbers, I mean, it's gibberish, right? It's really, that's how I think of it, that it's sort of a name that was used to say everything out of his mouth is gibberish. That's how I took it. And I take it as so derogatory. And as you said, just kind of retracting everything he was likely about, meaning, you know, very well educated and just a way to really put him down. And I thought it was also interesting that literally this became his name amongst.
She put it in her phone. That was his name in Wendy's phone.
It was just unbelievable. So I want to talk about this, you know, hatred. Just you can just see it seething even when Wendy was on the stand. And I want to put a picture of Wendy up for those of you who might not know who she was. This was a picture actually from her on the stand. And I always laugh because she's constantly sort of looking away and thinking and in my opinion, just being evasive on her testimony. What were your reflections about her testimony?
Okay, so she's testified 4 times. She is doing much better this time. To go towards your demeanor on the stand, in the last prior three times that she testified, she really couldn't talk about Danny without making some nasty remark about him. Even when she had to acknowledge that he was brilliant, she would kind of find a way to also put him down. I think it made her look bad on the stand. She was still fighting against Danny, even, you know, almost a decade after his death. Her claim is that he was emotional, but nobody saw it because he handled it so well. And so he was well known for being a very, very devoted parent. And she will also sort of have to acknowledge that, but then also kind of put him down and say, well, yeah, he pretends to be a devoted parent, but I'm actually the one that did all of the parenting, because Danny was such a, you know, Danny was such an amazing scholar that he spoke all over the country. But this is a man that after the divorce, when Wendy had his children, you know, when the custody was that she would have the children, he would go, very busy man. Remember, this is a guy that is an incredible scholar. He does all of this work, but he would make time to go to the daycare to have lunch with his 2 children because he missed them so much because they weren't in his custody at that time. Wendy actually tried to stop that, which is completely ridiculous. If you think about wanting to have involved children, wanting to have an involved father, you really couldn't have gotten a more involved father than Danny Markell.
And so what was the real rub? What was it, her wanting to have these affairs? Was it the influence from Donna? What was the rub that caused this relationship to not only dissipate and die out, but become this hateful?
Yeah, I think there are a number of things. I mean, obviously some of this is going to be my opinion, and then there are other pieces of it that can be proven. I think she felt like she was eclipsed by him. She was also a lawyer, but did not have as prestigious a job. She was actually on what's called soft money, which means that it was grant money funded for her job, which meant really that it could go away at any time if they didn't get the renewal on the grants. So she was not a tenured professor. Her job was not guaranteed. I think that there was a lot of competition. She felt really degraded that he was the one that traveled more. She was the one that probably did take more care of the children. I think Wendy's mother, Dan's mother-in-law, interfered all along in this relationship. They were very angry that the grandchildren were in Tallahassee when they live in Miami. And that's somewhere between an 8-hour and a 10-hour drive. Now, it's important to note that the Adelsons are very wealthy. Harvey Adelson ran, I guess he sold it at some point to his son, Charlie, but I actually think it's back in his name. But it was a very, very lucrative dental practice. Harvey being a general dentist, his son Charlie worked with him, you know, early on worked with him, and then I guess apparently at one point bought the practice from Harvey. He was a periodontist, so he was a specialist. So between the two of them, nobody will really reveal how much money we're talking about, but it's definitely in the millions every year. So the grandchildren are far away, but they certainly have the resources to fly in and see them pretty much at any time. Donna was working as Harvey's office manager, and so it's not like she couldn't get the time off, but she wanted sort of her brood to all be under her control. And so if you're asking me how this happened and what interfered in the marriage, I think you would have to say that Donna Adelson and the rest of the family were very, very much part of that. They didn't like the idea that Danny was keeping Wendy, according to them, keeping Wendy in Tallahassee, because we professors don't have a ton of mobility, right? If we're a tenured professor, it is more difficult. It seems strange to people who are not professors. It's more difficult to get a job somewhere else. You would have to give up tenure. Now, Danny was a rock star, so Danny definitely would have been able to move to a different school. And I think all along the plan was that he would. But the fact that he had to stay in Tallahassee and not be under the umbrella of the rest of the Adelson family in Miami was really, really difficult for Donna Adelson was furious about it. And it was difficult for Wendy because she was sort of caught in the middle of this, right? I have to divorce this guy because he's not going to comply with what my family wants. And I feel intimidated by him.
You know, it's so interesting to me that a matriarch of a family like Donna, who seemingly was very normal, I got a kick out of watching her on Wheel of Fortune. And I couldn't believe the irony of the clue. And then also the irony of when she was asked what she does of those answers. Do you want to discuss that with us a little bit? Because I was shaking my head going, is this an acting job here?
Well, there's a lot of acting jobs going on here. The acting actually is a theme through this trial. But let me answer your question specifically about The Price is Right. So she's on The Price is Right. It is clearly in the 1980s or 1990s. So the outfit that she's wearing isn't doing any favors. So she has during that time, it was the power suits and the shoulder pads that went out to here. She's on The Price is Right, and when she introduces herself, they ask her what she does, and she says, I'm a domestic coordinator. Now, I don't want to make too much fun of that. That is the way to speak of it as opposed to saying a housewife, which is what it would have been called at that time. And I don't love the idea of a housewife either. I do get that. But the idea, and it just is so ironic given what she is now on trial for, because what she said is, I am responsible for controlling all of the things that go on in my household. She names all of her children. I believe that her son, the oldest son, Robbie Adelson, was 16 at the time. Charlie was 15. And then Wendy was, I don't really remember, but younger than 10 or 11. And she sort of itemizes, I have to get everyone to different practices, you know, and control their schoolwork. And then, of course, I work with my husband. And so even at that time, when she's just a sweet little lady wearing her 1980s haircut and shoulder pads, she is talking about being in control. So I don't actually think that there's such a discrepancy between her in the 1980s and what she ends up being in the 2010s, right? When Danny Markell's murder occurred, Donna saw herself as the center of everyone's life. I think there's lots of indications of this all the way through the trial. She is the center of everyone's life. And everything kind of revolves around her. It's like, I am the sun and all of the planets that are my children and other people in my orbit are revolving around me. So let me give you one example of that from this trial. One of the pieces of evidence that is very compelling is they found her day planner. They had her day planner from recently, but they managed to find the day planner from 2014, which is when Danny was killed. And in that day planner, she had his license plate listed. Now, granted, she had a lot of information on everyone. She actually had VIN numbers. She might have had VIN numbers for Charlie's cars. She had the grandchildren's social security. Pretty much every piece of information was written down. But you have to remember, in 2014, they had been divorced for 2 years. Why do you have the license plate number of your former son-in-law in your day planner unless you're giving it to someone, you know, like a hitman? But also the fact that, so the defense is trying to argue, but she wrote down everything, which is true. She was very compulsive about having absolutely everything in her day planner, which is not helping her right now in court. But you know, I had everything and I wrote down everything, but her former son-in-law's license plate number, you know, that shows the level of control that Donna Adelson had over her family.
Well, I can tell you when I saw that piece of evidence come up and I tweeted about it. I know, like, this is called a clue. That is just one of the strongest pieces of evidence. I know that there's so much evidence here. I mean, we've got the hitmen, we've got Magnanabaugh, we've got, you know, the jailhouse folks that I really want to get into too. The evidence is overwhelming, but when you find something like that,
that's incredible. That's incredible.
It's substantive. It shows this link. But what I really liked about it, I'm going to say that, is Wendy. To me, she doesn't get that, but for Wendy. What are your thoughts on that? Because I think this helps tie Wendy in.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on Wendy. I mean, Wendy is the one that anyone who's followed this case, she is the one that everyone wants to see go to prison. And I know that sounds like a terrible thing to say, but this man was shot in his driveway, actually in his garage, after dropping his two children off at daycare and then, you know, going to the gym to work out. He didn't have a chance. He pulled into his driveway. The hitmen climbed out. They were blocking his way. And they climbed out and put two bullets in his head, right? He was just incredibly vulnerable. But in terms of, you know, they needed that information. They needed a license plate. Did Wendy get it or did Donna get it? Now, I do think that there's some arguments to be made that Donna spent a lot of time in Tallahassee. You can't keep control of your grandchildren unless you come into Tallahassee. But I do think it's a very interesting piece of evidence. Wendy, in this trial, has come off in some ways looking like she was less involved. I believe that she was more involved, but she is a lawyer. She knows how to protect herself, right? But there are certain pieces of evidence that make Wendy look guilty. But over the course of this trial, so the first 2 or 3 days, the arguments were difficult with respect to Donna because they were pointing at so many other people. There's multiple people involved in this conspiracy. And there were things that made Wendy look guilty and kind of pointing the finger at Wendy, that Wendy's really the one that did this and contributed the information. And I do think she contributed information. But for the first 3 days of trial, all the commentators and me myself were looking at this trial and saying, where's Donna in all of this? What you're doing here, prosecution, is demonstrating what everyone else did. And if we're going to show what everyone else did, does that kind of mitigate or lessen Donna's responsibility? But boy, do those prosecutors know what they're doing. So Georgia Kappelman, who is the lead prosecutor, it is at the moment slipping my mind who her co-counsel is. It's kind of odd because they both are gorgeous blonde women and it's easy to kind of, their voices even sound the same. It's easy to kind of mix them up. But Georgia Kappelman has tried this case 4 times. She knows what she's doing. And my concern of it, the first 3 days looked like it was about everyone else instead of Donna. My concern about that was very much answered during the last 2 days, Thursday and Friday, where they now brought in all of the evidence that strongly suggests that Donna was involved and was the person that orchestrated it. Let me go back just for a second to Wendy. I think Wendy's guilty, but they will have a hard time proving it, partly because Donna and Charlie, who were the two sort of masterminds of this, very obviously, and not just about this murder, but about so many things in Wendy Adelson's life, controlled her and treated her like she was a princess and a baby. Right before Charlie sought a hitman, literally the day before, Wendy Adelson had put a contract, or at least had, I think it was a contract, put a contract on a home in Tallahassee. Well, you have to remember, Donna Adelson wants her in Miami. She does not want her owning a home in, you know, Northern Florida. She wants her in Miami. And so you see text exchanges where Donna's like, she's just about to get this house. We need to stop her. And she wouldn't listen to me. So I think she'll listen to you. And so Charlie, after speaking to Wendy, gets back to his mother and says, I talked her out of buying the house. She's going to get out of the contract. And so Wendy, who I believe is guilty, you have to acknowledge that Charlie and Donna did control them. Now, I think there are pieces of evidence that are that do point to Wendy's guilt. But this trial in particular has some elements of it that if I were a defense attorney, I would point to them. Look, this text shows that they're plotting behind her back to get to Miami. This text demonstrates that we don't want Wendy involved. And so this is the first time that I've actually sort of thought that Wendy will be harder to prosecute if they decide to prosecute her at all.
I think she'll be harder to prosecute. Sorry, I just had to put up a picture of Donna's defense counsel.
Boy, do I have a lot to say about her.
Yeah, I want to get into that because, I mean, what is going on here? There have been few trials, certainly none that I was involved in, and in reality, in life as an FBI agent, and really none as I've gotten into this world of true crime and being a commentator on, television about crime. This is something. Actually, the way she looks in this picture sort of is a personification of her skills as a defense counsel. And I know she was a judge, but my understanding—
I was going to say, she was a judge. Why is she so bad? She's so bad at this.
My understanding is she's forced out, and I'm kind of on a roll right now for anybody who follows me on all of these judges, because I think these judges become judges, and they're awful, so many of them. Speaking of like Emmanuel Haro's judge, or the judge of the father, Jake Haro, that let him out with no time being served after he close to murdered his first 10-week-old child. And many others.
I don't know that case.
Well, every week I put on another judge that has allowed people out that have committed serious crime. But I don't want to digress. Let's get back to Donna Adelson's attorney.
So one of the things I want to point out about this is a piece, very, very significant pieces of evidence in this trial are the jailhouse calls between Donna Adelson and Charlie Adelson, who had been convicted. A week to the day after Charlie is convicted is when Donna and her husband appear, this is part of the argument, appear to be escaping to Vietnam on one-way tickets. But the reason why I mentioned the jailhouse calls is because right after Charlie was convicted, he goes on this rant about Georgia Kappelman. And he does this, fake Southern accent when he's, trying to reproduce her. He makes her sound like Foghorn Leghorn. And they're making fun of how much of a country bumpkin she is. And that, I guess Miami is so much more sophisticated than Tallahassee. And, there's this country bumpkin prosecutor who speaks with this Southern accent and is cutesy and can appeal to the jury because she's kind of dumb. And why I find that so interesting is this defense attorney, and I'm so sorry, I cannot remember her name offhand. You probably know it. She has the thickest Southern accent, and she comes off just unbelievably looking like a moron. And I don't think she is. So on the first day of the trial, in her opening statement, she says, she's talking about Skype because Danny Markell, when he was not with his children, he wanted to Skype with them. And remember, 2014, that was the technology. FaceTime wasn't yet a thing. And this lawyer in her opening statement says, I know all of you to the jury, most of you are younger than I am, and you might not have ever heard of this thing called Skype. So I don't really know what that is. It's like, I guess it's a piece of technology. And she just kind of presents herself as a country bumpkin. And so it's funny, they made fun of Georgia Kappelman, who isn't a country bumpkin at all. And then they went out and hired someone that is the stereotype of the very person they were making fun of in the jailhouse calls.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Sorry. Oh my gosh. Sorry about that. My phone has just completely went off on its own.
Good. Can I say one other thing about her that you may, I don't know if you know this or not.
Jackie Crawford, by the way, is her name. Sorry.
What's her name?
I believe it's Judge Jackie Fulford, as I recall.
I believe that's right. Yeah, that sounds right. She was late to court on Friday, and the excuse that she gave to the judge was, I took a sleeping pill and I could not wake up, right? That is so deeply problematic. I mean, can you imagine, you know, it seems to me that the judge should have said, Mrs. Adelson, how do you feel about being represented by someone who was too drugged out to get to court today? And so she just strikes me as a mess. And then her questioning is, it's mind-blowingly bad. It's just hard to imagine what the theory of the case they have, right? The defense, it's, they're kind of all over the place. And many of the things that many of their cross-examinations actually ask questions where it's pretty clear they don't know the answer, right? Like that's the cardinal rule number one with a defense attorney is never, ever ask a question that you don't know the answer to. But in multiple of the cross-examinations, it's pretty clear that the witnesses surprised her with what they said. She's extremely disorganized. She doesn't have a file folder. She has a bunch of loose papers that have sticky notes on it. When the defense says, I'm done with this witness, you sort of expect, I'm sorry, when the prosecution says, I'm done with this witness, you expect the defense counsel to be absolutely prepared to do cross-examination. But what we're seeing, and this isn't once or twice, this is all the way through, what we're seeing is, okay, judge, I'm not quite ready, and the shuffling of papers and the moving of the, you know, of the lectern, and they just look like a mess. And Donna Adelson is a wealthy, wealthy woman. It is completely, it's baffling to me why these are her lawyers.
Yeah, it really is. But this is the thing that I do believe with people when they go to find a lawyer, especially in a small town like Tallahassee, because Tallahassee is small. It's really a college town.
But the university is huge.
It is. It's huge. But I'm just talking about compared to like a Miami. Right. It made sense to me that they would want to go with somebody locally, if you will. And Right. Also as a judge, you would think that they have those kinds of connections and that they would be well received, that they would work well with another judge. A judge would have high respect for them. But what a disaster. I really worry about this if she's convicted on appeal, because I'm not sure that they don't have some very good arguments for a Sixth Amendment issue. And Yep. What I guess I'm saying is when people ask why in the world was she ever hired when they have that kind of money, millions of dollars, although I would guess that money is dwindling fast.
Yes, yeah.
Dwindle down a lot. But certainly they have money to get an attorney, and this should be the most important thing that they would have on their plate. I think they bet that this ploy or this idea would be a good idea, and it just wasn't because of the
quality. And I mean, yeah, you know, I do think that she has grounds on, they have grounds on for appeal on in assistance of counsel, right? That's the plea. Because I think her counsel's terrible, but you want to win the trial. You don't want to have to go to appeal, right? There are so many instances, and I will say this, I really admire and respect Georgia Kappelman, the prosecutor, the lead prosecutor, the lead attorney on the prosecution side. I have nothing but respect for her. I've watched her in all four of those trials. I think she's very good. But all the way through this, she has been asking incredibly leading questions. She's been doing a lot of things that, you know, probably shouldn't be allowed, but the defense is not objecting to them. They're not preserving the record by saying we object to this. They're just letting her go. So she's asking leading questions. They should object. They're not doing it. So I do think Donna Adelson will have a very good argument for in assistance of counsel, because she's not getting good assistance of counsel. But you don't want to bet on an appeal. You want to win the case, right? You don't want to pay for an appeal. And so you do just wonder what the hell is going on. Now, I'm sorry, I'm talking too much. I apologize.
No, you're not at all. This was the whole idea. I know how well you know this case. And I really want to get into some of the, just your perspective on some of the whys. We've talked about it earlier on, but I want to talk a little bit how Charlie fits into this mix, you know, and how Harvey fits into this fits into this mix. I know we have a matriarch that is completely controlling and in charge, but how are these men going along with it, Charlie, to the point of really orchestrating this murder?
I mean, I have a son. I understand. I don't want my son to be a mommy's boy, but I don't think there's anything we can call him except that, right? He is so, Charlie, I'm talking about Charlie here. Charlie is so dependent on his mother. It's almost like, please love me, mommy. And if I do all the things that you want me to do, will you love me? Will you love me? And so they have almost a pathologically close relationship. So how does she control these men? It's unclear what Harvey knows. There is one video at a restaurant called Dolce Vita where Harvey is caught on being recorded by the FBI. And it's pretty clear he knows what's going on. Now, whether that's accessory after the fact, there are also phone calls where Donna says, we can talk about this because your dad's not here. So it's not entirely clear what Harvey knew. They clearly wanted to insulate Harvey from a lot of this. I think everyone in the family was involved. This was mostly a plot, I believe. Now, Donna has not been convicted, so I want to be very careful, you know, innocent until proven guilty, but it's not looking good for her. Charlie has already been convicted, and it very much is that Charlie follows what Donna wants him to do. And we can see that all the way down the line, and not just about the issues in this case or the issues that relate to the murder. They are convince Wendy not to buy the house. And then Charlie did, right? Take care of your sister in this way. And then Charlie did, right? Charlie kind of follows orders from Donna, and in kind of a weirdly pathetic way, almost like a mommy's boy, right? Like, I'm a good boy. I'll go do what you want me to do. Which is really funny because his image otherwise is kind of as this playboy with tons of money that loves go-karts and jet skis and has, you know, has seven cars, including a former police car and a Ferrari, you know. But when it comes to his mom, he seems to really follow orders.
You know, I always thought it was so interesting how Dan Markell, I think, had, I don't know, a 2004 Honda. Something
isn't
like
that hilarious? Yeah.
Maybe 2008. I mean, it was mini 6-7 year old car, and the juxtaposition between the Adelsons and Markell. Wow. It was just so, you know, different.
It's so funny. I heard that today. You know, you always get, there are lots of pieces of trials that you don't remember. And because it was actually written down, I think it was because it was written down in your day planner. And I think you're absolutely right. It was a 2004 or 2006. And then Wendy also had an older van. Wasn't that much older. I think hers was like a 2008. But you're right. I mean, and I think this is part of the anger that Donna and Harvey have is, what the hell, if you're this good and this respected, why are you teaching law school and not making more money? So when Donna was trying to force or help Wendy to come down to South Florida, Wendy was working as a immigration lawyer, and that is clearly her passion. She really does love that. She actually wrote an extremely bad book using some of her, a model of some of her clients, right? But she really sees herself as being sort of the great white hope for immigrants, right? So for trafficking victims and immigrants. And you can, it's clear that that's the kind of law Wendy wants to practice, but they're trying to make an argument for why she should move to Miami. And one of the pieces of that argument was that you could make you could have a much higher paying job here. So Donna convinces a friend of hers who is a lawyer to make an offer to Wendy, I believe for Wendy to make $1 million a year. I mean, that would be very different from the whatever $40,000 a year she's making as an adjunct professor at Florida State in Tallahassee. But it's also pretty clear that Wendy doesn't want to practice corporate law. She doesn't really want to have a job that's $1 million a year. But I think Donna judged Danny because if you're so great, why aren't you here? If you're so great, why aren't you making more money? What the hell are you doing driving an old car? We have tons of money. You're not pulling your weight. And so everything was sort of forced on them. I don't have sympathy for Wendy because I think Wendy was involved, but I will say that there are aspects of Wendy's story that are very, very sad, and they have to do with her mother controlling her and not treating her as a full-grown adult.
Oh, God. Okay, I got to stop you there. But I appreciate the empathy you have, and I know that your background, of course, lends to sort of understanding and looking deeper. But Wendy, I see as somebody who doesn't fall far from the tree. She might have that look about her, like, woe is me. I mean, even on the stand, I found her almost to be a little bit airheady-like. You know,
it's amazing. Yeah.
We call him Chippers. You know, I felt like she was a teenager. The
right.
whole time she was on that stand, that was just the vibe I got from her in terms of how she answered questions and sort of this weird smile she would get. And she just really creeped me out, to be honest, as a human. And how much of this do you think is an act? You talked earlier about how bad Donna looks, which I've got a picture of her up here with her headphone backwards and everything else.
Wow, they are backwards. Okay.
One is inverted, which I was actually on Court TV when they brought this picture up, and I was like, wow. But nevertheless, my point is what do you really think Wendy is just coddled, or do you really think this is more of an act?
I think all of them. I think both are true. I think both things can be true at the same time. They definitely treat her like a teenager. They definitely treat her, by they, I mean Donna. I don't mean Donna and Harvey, her actual parents. I mean Donna and Charlie really treat her like she's a teenager. So I don't think she's that. She's a very smart woman. She herself has a law degree from the University of Miami. She went to Brandeis. She also went to Cambridge and got a master's degree. This is a smart, well-educated woman. She is a lawyer in her own right. She is a professor in her own right. So I clearly don't think she has agency. Obviously, she has agency. But they do treat her like she doesn't. And it almost seems like she falls in line with being the little kid when she is with regard to her mother. So one of the things that comes out in this testimony is it's not exactly clear that she really wanted to go to Miami. She writes an email to a friend where she says, you know, I'm fighting so hard for something that I may not actually really want, namely moving to Miami. She did love her job. She says, you know, I love my job. This is in her email to her friend. I love my job. It gives me maximum flexibility. It gives me a lot of time to be with my children. And she kind of knows that if she moves to Miami and ends up in some kind of corporate job, she's definitely not going to have that. She actually says at one point, I don't remember the wording, but it's something like, I just don't want to confront my family. I don't want to tell my family that I don't want to move to Miami. So that's the one side. I said both things could be true at once. I do think she is treated like a child and that she sometimes falls back into the child mode, right? Like, I'm afraid of acknowledging what I want with my family. So I do believe she has agency, but that is how they treat her. They treat her like a little kid. I also know acting has become part of the testimony in this case. Donna writes these insane, literally crazy. And you know that I work in psychiatry. I don't usually use insane. I don't use words like insane and crazy. Just unbalanced. Let's go with unbalanced. Emails arguing for telling Wendy, who is a lawyer, ways that she can make Danny crazy so that he allows Wendy to move. And among the suggestions that she makes in this email, now this is a Jewish family. Let me be very clear. This is a Jewish family. Dress them up in Hitler Youth costumes. Danny was a very devout Jew, a much more devout Jew than the Adelson family. So she suggests it will drive Danny crazy to see them dressed up as Hitler Youth. One of the other things is baptize them in the Catholic Church. Take a photo of them in front of a church. and, you know, talk about new beginnings. So she's, you know, giving all of these wild, just completely irrational, suggestions to Wendy. Do these things so that we get relocation. You are a good actor. I've seen you in action many, many times. You will have to put on the performance of your life. So that's why I think both things are true. I think Donna controlled her. I think in some ways she saw herself as a child. She was certainly treated as a child by both Donna and Charlie. But, you know, that is a very interesting claim, right? I know you can be a good actor when you want to. I have seen you in action. Put on the performance of your life. The other person who has testified in all four of the trials is her former boyfriend, Jeffrey Lacasse, who I have nothing but respect for, who is just a very careful, he has all the receipts, man, and I do mean it. He literally has receipts of things that happen, like the dinners that they have. He knows all the dates because he kept all the information. And in his testimony on multiple occasions, he refers to her as well as an actor. That she puts on an act in front of other people, that she pretends to be very social, but the minute they leave the house, all she does is bitch about how awful they are. So Wendy being a good actor and putting on a face for whatever she's trying to accomplish is something that has come up in testimony.
Yeah, I think that that will be critical if indeed she is charged. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think she'll be charged? You've talked a lot about sort of both sides of the pancake, you know, the positives toward charging Wendy in terms of evidence and against charging Wendy in terms of evidence. What do you think the prosecution will do? Or do you think it's dependent on whether they get a conviction here?
There are parts of this case that almost feel like they're using this jury as a grand jury, that they're presenting some evidence about Wendy, kind of with the idea to kind of feel out how they are responding to Wendy. Georgia Kappelman has been extremely disciplined about the way she's trying the cases. She's kind of done one and then the other and then the other. And she seems to gather evidence from all of the trials that precede the trial that comes next. So the trial of Sigfredo Garcia and Luis Rivera, who were the actual hitmen. Sigfredo is the person who pulled the trigger. They were actually Luis Rivera made a deal with the prosecution. He got a sweetheart deal. I think he only got 9 years because he turned on everyone immediately. Sigfredo Garcia and Catherine Magnanua. I know I pronounce her name wrong. I've tried very hard. There's a B in there, Magnanua. The way that I've heard it said is Catherine Magnanua. And in fact, I listened to her say it, and that's the best I can do. So if anyone has criticisms, I'm sorry about the pronunciation of her name. She is the middleman. So Sigfredo was her, you know, sort of common law husband and definitely baby daddy. And she convinced him to go to Tallahassee to shoot Danny. Luis Rivera was the ride along childhood friend. So the first people, so Luis Rivera cut a deal. He didn't go to trial. Luis Rivera, Sigfredo Garcia, and Catherine Magnanua were tried together. He was found guilty, sentenced to life in prison. She had a mistrial. Then there was a trial of her. She was found guilty. She is now in life in prison. And the rumor out there is that she was actually offered full immunity to testify against the Adelsons and turned it down. So I don't know how true that is. Georgia
attorney was the same one that Donna has.
Is that right?
No, I'm winking.
Oh, the same bad one. I'm sorry. So Georgia Kappelman has been incredibly organized, right? I'm going to get the information from Luis Rivera. I'm going to use that information and force him to testify because that's part of his plea deal in the trial of Sigfredo Garcia and Catherine Magnanua. And then I'm going to try them. And then I'm going to use all the information that I got from those trials to use against Charlie. So Charlie was the next person who was charged. And then a week later, Donna Adelson is arrested walking into her plane with her one-way ticket to Vietnam. And you see in this trial, all of the evidence that was presented against Charlie being presented against Donna. So all of that is to say, I know that's a long explanation, but all of that is to say, Georgia Kappelman has been very careful. I'm going to do this trial. I'm going to use that evidence to do the next trial. I'm going to use that evidence to do the next trial. And so here we are with Donna. And the speculation is, depending on how this trial goes, Wendy will be next.
Right. And I totally see that. I think that that was the plan from the beginning. I think she's a very calculated prosecutor. I think she knew it would be a huge mistake to throw out the rope, round everybody up and try to do one big trial. She did this so brilliantly. And I really think this is her game plan, dependent on whether she gets a conviction here. I almost interrupted you and I'm sorry, but
no, I'm talking constantly. So it's okay.
No, I should never interrupt, but it was just when you were talking about the one-way tickets to Vietnam, I just wanted to say that was absolutely getting out of the country. Vietnam has no extradition. She would have been over there in a probably a really swanky hut. And I think that that points to Harvey's involvement and that he could be the last one charged. If they go with Wendy, I think Harvey could be, but maybe not on the conspiracy part because of the, I know exactly that piece of testimony you're talking about where they say something like, we can't talk because Harvey's around.
Right.
And that would, if they got a good defense attorney, they would likely really jump just on that one piece of evidence. But I also agree with you that the, I believe it was Dolce Vita was that restaurant.
Yes.
If I'm remembering it right, yes. That is recorded in what we call a measure instead of a FISA situation. We call those measures basically a surveillance of a microphone that's next to the person as opposed to a telephone. Anyway, and that seems like he knows. Minimally, he knows. Did he participate? Did he do two overt acts, which he would have to convict him? You know, I don't know. He's going to be the hardest one.
I don't think it's hard at all. We 100% know that Harvey knew because two of the major, major pieces of evidence in this case are the jailhouse calls. So Donna was making jailhouse calls constantly with Charlie and they were careful when they were on the line, but then they would get disconnected and Donna did not understand that she had to hang up the phone. So she did this twice. She was cut off. She believed that she had disconnected the line, but prison phone lines are always, always recorded. So she doesn't actively hang up. So her phone records everything. And in one of the conversations, Harvey is in the room. There's also a friend in the room. So I'm not exactly sure what the story is on that. And the conversation is, we are looking for places that do not have extradition policies with the United States. The airline tickets were planned very deliberately. There was a stopover. The stopover was in Dubai. Dubai also does not have an extradition treaty with the United States. And in that jailhouse call, she thought she had hung up, but she hadn't. So she continues to record. They are having discussions about how we're trying to move money around. We're trying to get prepared to go ahead and leave from Vietnam. And she actually has a discussion about places that do not have extradition with the United States. And Harvey was part of that conversation. So there is no doubt at all that Harvey knows. Now, whether or not, and I do not know the laws of Florida, whether or not he was only a witness after the fact, and if that matters in a conspiracy, you can probably tell me. But the other little piece of information that I'll add is he's 85 years old. So is it worth it to go through a whole nother trial? Is it worth the expense when he's 85 years old?
Well, Florida isn't shy about going after people that are older, and really no states are, especially when it involves murder. But I don't think they have the goods on him for the murder, but aiding and abetting, you know, an after the fact, a harboring type of charge. I think they have, based on the whole Vietnam information. The other thing that I think is worrisome is what would be allowed from that conversation. If I'm a defense attorney, I'm up there saying, listen, you know, this law is written for conversations between the inmate and the person called, and the fact she didn't hang up, I just know that that would be a huge argument anyway to motion against that conversation being qualified as legal. So I just think
they're using it in the Donna Adelson case, though.
Did they get? But again, the quality of the attorney. Just imagine if this were Alan Jackson. For those of you who followed the other trial, he would have put.
Couldn't stop thinking. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I literally during the defense could not stop thinking about Alan Jackson and what a good defense attorney he is. And I'm like, you know, Donna, you could have afforded Alan Jackson. You should have gone with Alan Jackson.
So there's so many others that are good attorneys and reputable. So I can't give both of those monikers to Alan Jackson, but he finds a way to get it done. There's no doubt about that. But again, I digress. Back to the point, I think Harvey could be next on the chopping block, but I do agree that 85 years old could be considered. I don't know. They've put so much money into this. I think they want the whole ring. Right. I want to ask you about Rob. Talk about the good son, because you've broken down to me. I'm just going to say it in layman's term, not in the psychiatric term, but you basically have a girl that's a great actress that is still controlled. She's still on the puppet strings, but really, in my opinion, she's getting what she wants and she is very manipulative. But also, then you have Charlie, who's a mama's boy, doing what mama wants to the degree that he would commit murder, conspiracy to commit murder, line all this out just to be on the good side of mama. Let's talk about Rob.
Oh my God. His testimony was heartbreaking. Yeah. If you saw it, you could tell that this was a man who was just bereft by all of this. But he also testified against his mother because he felt like he had to. So the story about Rob Adelson, who was estranged from the family. He was estranged from the family, not completely estranged. He was definitely away from the family long before the murder plot. The big story about him, and this also goes to Donna's control, is that he fell in love with a woman who is Indian, of Indian descent. I don't know if she's from India. Fell in love with her and wanted to marry her, but she was not Jewish. The Adelson family is Jewish, but not as Jewish as Dan Markell was. So you have to be Jewish of a certain kind. But if you're too Jewish, we don't like you. But in Rob's case, when he was much younger, they pressured him and pressured him and pressured him that he could not marry the woman that he really loved. I don't want to mispronounce her name, so I just won't, that he really loved. And he actually broke up with her and then married a nice Jewish girl from, and he says this, these are his words, a nice Jewish girl, I think from Dallas. And he is so miserable. He feels like it's so unfair to the woman that he married that they annul the marriage very quickly. And he goes on to marry the woman that he really loved. But you can see, right? We don't want you marrying her. And it was so powerful that he didn't marry her at first, even though she was the love of his life, clearly the love of his life. And when he married the person that essentially Donna chose for him, he figured out that it was just wrong. And he annulled the marriage and basically was willing to break away from his family in order to have his own life and to have autonomy. Rob Adelson did the thing that I am saying I don't think Wendy was able to do, right? Which is to say, you don't get to control me. At the end of the day, I want to have a relationship with you, but if those are your terms, it's not worth it to me. So he did do certain things with the family, but he lives in New York and he certainly didn't let them control him. They did develop relationships with his two children and his wife, but it was always chilly. And they really kind of have their own life in New York. He's an ear, nose, and throat doctor there. She is also a physician. And so Rob was not going to let them control him. And so he's sort of almost like the outlier in this family. But watching him testify, where he testifies about how controlling his mother is from the beginning of his life, from his whole life, he's the oldest child. And it must have been so unbelievably hard to do this against your own mother. But he did it because he felt like it was the right thing to do. When you watch that testimony, it is hard to watch him. You can tell just this overwhelming, that he is doing this with an overwhelming sense of sadness. It's all you can feel coming off of him. And so I think he's an evidence of a lot of things. I think he's evidence of what it means to be the good person who tells the truth. I also think he is evidence of how controlling that family is and was, and what they wanted you to give up in order to remain under the family's wing.
Yeah, it's really amazing that he did that. I keep wondering how many of us would, how many of us would turn our backs on our family, but for the right reason. I just have so much respect for him for being able to do that. I really do.
Please. Okay. His testimony, he also has a very interesting piece of evidence in his own testimony, which is he found out about the murder the next day. And they basically called him and said, yeah, this is a tragedy. There was a murder. We can't talk right now. Even though Donna and Harvey are talking to him, they are in the car, either driving to or from Tallahassee. So, why would they not have been able to speak to him? It was like, hi, Danny was shot. We don't know who did it. Actually, they gave him a weird story. They said, we were told that a hitman walked up to the door, rang the doorbell, said, are you Danny Markell? And then shot him. Obviously, that is not what happened, but that was the story he was told. And he said, how would you possibly know that? The only person who would know that is Dan Markell. Oh, that was just what we were told. And then sort of immediately after that, they weren't giving him any information. And what he says on the stand is they just weren't curious. My friends, people, in New York were curious about it. If it had been about a neighbor doing this or a neighbor dying by a hitman, everyone would be talking about it. But my family absolutely would not talk about it. When I asked questions, they would cut me off. And even when there was an arrest, they didn't call him right away. He spoke to them a couple days later and he said, aren't you thrilled? They arrested the people that probably killed, that might've killed Danny. Aren't you happy? And Donna said to him, at least what he says on the trial is, I don't know. I don't care. It doesn't have anything to do with me. And so their lack of curiosity, their unwillingness to talk about it just makes them look guilty as hell.
Yeah, I think for me, he was really one of the most powerful witnesses because, as you point out, he gives the whole picture of the dynamic and the control. And without understanding that, without understanding that motive and that dynamic, I think even though the other evidence is good, it would have been a tough one. I want to talk and close on, I think, I'm of course going to ask you what I left out because I might have. I want to talk about these jailhouse informants, snitches, whatever we want to call them. I made a career on jailhouse snitches. I think that they are invaluable when you can corroborate the information. And of course, one was corroborated with that amazing script was written.
God, that letter.
Photos and all of that. Talk to us about the jailhouse informant.
So there are two jailhouse informants. I'm just so bad with names. I apologize. But the first woman to testify, Donna actually had referred to her as her prison daughter. And it's sad. It's clear that she doesn't know what.
Nickname was Sunshine and prison house daughter, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I don't remember that. And she testifies that Donna, actually confessed to her and said, I I was involved, but I didn't think they would take it that far. So sort of the implication being, you know, I wanted him maybe, I don't know, to be roughed up or to be scared, but I never thought that they would kill him. That's sort of the implication. So she kind of confesses to this woman. The second one is just astonishing. I have never, ever, I'm a huge trial watcher. I have never seen anything like this. Donna wrote a script in her own handwriting of, so the thing is that she had been in prison with, actually both of them had been in prison with Katie Magnenua at some point, again, butchering that name. And the idea was, did you know her? And I think both of them sort of say, I think they knew her, but they didn't necessarily know her that well. And so what Donna wanted was both of these women to say that Katie confessed, that Katie had, Charlie's argument in his own trial was, I didn't tell anyone to kill Danny Markell. They knew from Katie, who I had been dating, that we were having a problem up north in Tallahassee, based on relocation. The mother wanted her kids, so that would be Wendy, wanted her kids to come down to Miami. And so that's why he's being killed. But Charlie's claim is, I never ordered the hit. Katie Magnanua knew that there was a problem with Danny. She was married to Sigfredo Garcia, who has a long criminal record, common law married. And then his best friend, Luis Rivera, who was a Latin king. And so she knew the people who could go and shoot someone in the head, basically. The idea that Charlie put forth is it was sort of a double extortion plot. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. It's my fault because I talked too much about your family situation at home. And so Sigfredo and his friend decided to kill him in advance. And there was this idea that the family would pay off Danny Markell, that they would give the family $1 million to have him let Wendy relocate. And so Katie said, well, I knew you were going to give them $1 million. And I talked too much about it at home. So Sigfredo and Lewis went up to Tallahassee and shot him. And now they want their $1 million. You have to give them the $1 million. And so Charlie's like, I don't have $1 million in cash. That's completely insane. And so he does like, what he claims is it's like a layaway plan for murder, right? I'm being extorted. I'm going to pay Katie in lots of different ways. I'm going to get her breast implants. I'm going to sell her Harvey's car at a much reduced rate. He offers her boat. He gives some amount of cash. It's pretty clear that Donna's the one that gives the cash. And so Donna wants these snitches. I don't know what else to call them besides snitches. He wants them to say, she wants them to say, I know Katie. They both called her Kay. Katie told us that she convinced her husband or boyfriend or whatever to go kill them, that it was really all of her fault. Katie confessed to us that she was the head of this plot. And so she wants them to testify that Katie confessed to them. So with the second jailhouse snitch, she actually writes a script for practice. Like when the prosecutor asks you this, memorize that you're going to say the following. And it is unbelievable that she did this, but it's also hilarious to read because she has things like, I convinced my boyfriend to kill them. He's such a fool. Ha ha. And it's like, what are we in the 1950s, right? Like, do you think Katie Magnanua is really going to say, my boyfriend is a fool? And so it's just this ridiculous thing that words that Katie would never say, very silly. And she wants this snitch to memorize this so that she can testify on her behalf about Katie being guilty. And so the prosecution calls these two women, obviously goes pretty much line by line through this script that Donna had written in her own handwriting. She actually kind of gives her a burn after reading order. So it's like, I'm going to give this to you and then you're going to copy it down in your own handwriting to memorize and you're going to give it back. So they're presenting evidence, they're reading this script. And when the defense has the opportunity to cross-examine, what they say is, we never denied that our client wrote that document. Have you ever seen anything like that?
Well, again, huge problem. Not only was her suit a huge problem, but the other problem was just to me, from beginning to end, I agree with everything you said about allowing all that leading testimony. This was part of the testimony that I was shocked that the prosecutor was allowed to completely lead this witness without any objection. But it was, par for this trial. And no, you can't say what that defense, the defense is helping the prosecution. That's how
it's amazing. They ask questions that like help the prosecution. It's crazy. They have the FBI agent on the stand that actually made the arrest at the airport. And she's asking him questions like, wow, you guys really, you did a lot to secure this. And it seems like you set up a lot of things in advance and you really worked together well with the Tallahassee police force, didn't you? And it's like, why do you have this? Why are you doing a cross-examination where you're letting this guy look like he's good? Aren't you supposed to tear him down? It is embarrassing how much legwork they have done for the prosecution in this trial.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I think that testimony, and I'm glad they ended with that. I think they ended with a real punch, that jailhouse informant, because that script, if anybody had any doubts, I mean, that is consciousness of guilt all over the place. Obviously, her leaving was a consciousness, or trying to leave to Vietnam, all of that shows consciousness of guilt. And then all the other evidence. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The defense attorney is questioning about her leaving to Vietnam and saying things like, well, there's nothing illegal about going to Vietnam in and of itself, is there? And, she wanted to go to Wendy's youngest child's bar mitzvah. She mentions it many times. So clearly she was going to come back in January for that. But one of the lines of questioning that she has is, well, I mean, when did you find out about this trip? When did you find out that they were getting on a plane? So basically the argument was something like, well, only at the last minute did you figure this out. Do you really know that it's true? And it's like, who cares when they figured it out? It doesn't matter when, it was sort of like, I think she actually says, if it wasn't for that one phone call to Charlie, you never would have investigated her for that. Well, yeah, but you had the one phone call from Charlie. Like, what are you asking, right? It's astonishing how bad the defense has been. I don't know what a good lawyer would have been able to do, but she doesn't have one.
Well said. I mean, it is a bunch of bad facts, but even, I just think you work harder at keeping things out. And as you said, discrediting witnesses, all the tricks. There were no tricks played here.
Well, you know the controversy about the lawyers, right?
No, please do tell.
Oh, okay. So Charlie's lawyer was Dan Roschbaum, I believe. Hope I don't get that wrong. And he was working with both Charlie and Donna, which any sensible lawyer would know they shouldn't be doing. That's just wrong. That's just silly. Like no judge should have allowed it. And no competent lawyer would have ever thought that that was a good idea. So Donna developed a relationship with Dan Roschbaum. And in fact, in that jailhouse call, she says, I don't know if we'll make it to Vietnam. Dan said that I could try. So she actually implicates her own lawyer in that, right? Like, it's pretty embarrassing that she sort of suggests, she doesn't say which Dan, but she says, Dan actually says, well, it's worth a try. She expected last year, this trial was supposed to start a year ago. Right before this trial starts, Charlie says, I do not give permission for my lawyer to represent you. It is a conflict of interest. I am trying to get an appeal, and there would be things that would come out that might incriminate me, that my own lawyer would have to incriminate me, and I'm trying to use this lawyer. And so Donna kind of had her lawyer pulled out from under her right before her trial was supposed to begin, which is why the trial was delayed by a year. And so I do think that there was a lot of like fear and moving around, because she had a plan. She had a plan of attack with this one lawyer. But it is ridiculous that anyone ever thought that lawyer should represent both Donna and Charlie.
Oh, it's a total conflict of interest. Sorry, I thought you meant something new with this lawyer.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Oh,
I'm glad you brought that up because I think that might also be why, although she was given a year with this attorney to learn the case, but the case is complicated.
Right.
You know, the case is really complicated with wiretaps and measures and everything else involved. Okay, couple more questions. They're going to be quickies. Number one. Okay. Do you think she will be convicted?
The only reason why, I do. I mean, I hope she is. So, you know, I'm not unbiased in this matter. If you had asked me this on Wednesday, I would have said, I don't know, because there was so much testimony that really pointed towards everyone else. But in the last 2 days, so Thursday and Friday, they did a brilliant job of, yes, I had to show you that all of these other people had a part of this because this is a conspiracy charge. But here's her part. And then to end with, to show all of the travel, to show all of the texts, and then to have the jailhouse snitches. If you had asked me on Wednesday, I would have said, they've proven that everyone else was involved, but they haven't done a good job proving that Donna was involved. But now, after they've settled their case, I think it was a brilliant strategy, and I do think she'll be convicted. Now, the defense has to put on their case in chief, but if their case in chief is anything like what we've been seeing for the last week and a half, I don't think she has a chance.
All right, number two, do you think that they will charge Wendy? If Donna is convicted, do you think they'll charge Wendy?
I hope they will charge Wendy. I would like them to charge Wendy. There is some bad evidence from the prosecution's standpoint, right? The texts where Donna protects her. In fact, in the bump, which we didn't really talk about, it's when the FBI sort of tickled the wire to get them talking to one another. In the bump, one of the pieces of information is they don't call the police. They look like they're being blackmailed. They don't call the police. Charlie calls his mother and she's doing all of these, like she's saying, doing everything except saying that she's being blackmailed. And he says, what does this have? Who does this involve? Like, you know, who's involved? I mean, is dad involved? No, dad's not involved. I mean, is it Wendy? No. She says like, no, like four times. No, Wendy's not involved. I think the two of us are, this is about the two of us. So she definitely incriminates Charlie. In that call, like if I were Wendy's defense attorney, I would say Donna Adelson herself said that she wasn't involved. And then in texts going forward in this trial, texts that they've presented, there's all this evidence of them manipulating Wendy from behind the scenes. I still think she's guilty. I think the biggest piece of evidence against Wendy is that she drove by the crime scene. And there's no way she, you know, makes this claim that she had to be on that side of town. It's a whole bizarre argument, but she drove past the crime scene.
Wasn't it for Thai food? I think for Thai.
I thought it was for a liquor store. She had to go buy this.
You're right. It was
the Bullet Bourbon, right?
The liquor store. You're right.
But she passed like five liquor stores on her way to this one liquor store. And in fact, she was going to lunch with friends and, there was a liquor store actually in the strip mall where they were eating. So it makes absolutely no sense. It also doesn't make sense to turn down that road because people were like, why were you, it's a shortcut. And everyone's looking at her like, no, it's not. But she absolutely saw her old house with crime tape around it, police cars. She does a 3-point turn in front of a police car. They actually, you know, have her, they had him testify. So why are you driving by the crime scene, Wendy? And then in jailhouse calls, Charlie and Donna actually make fun of her for that. Oh, I mean, she's such an airhead. And, you know, it just makes us look really guilty that she drove near the crime scene, but she was just going to the liquor store to her old house. So the crime scene thing makes it really look bad for Wendy. Some of the texts make it really look bad for Wendy. It is hard to imagine that they could have possibly known Dan's schedule in any way if Donna didn't. If Wendy was not involved, how would they know where Dan was going to be. Some of the things she said to Jeffrey Lacoste, her ex-boyfriend. I do think there's a lot of evidence of Wendy's guilt, but then there's all these kind of problematic, Georgia Kappelman would have to get around some of the problematic testimony that kind of indicates that that Donna and Charlie were trying to keep things from her. I hope they will charge her. I hope they will not be dissuaded by that. She also has immunity for her testimony because they forced her to do it. So I don't know, but let's just leave it with, I hope, and I do think there's some good evidence, but there are also hurdles to get through.
I think that's really well stated. And that's why this prosecutor did this in this order.
And Julia, who's got the comment up here, she did give three different accounts. I mean, the accounts are just completely insane. And they changed from, I think there were more than three accounts, but yeah, she's given multiple accounts of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I still think, I know Donna's the ringleader, but at the heart, in a huge way, is Wendy. Wendy had everything to gain, truly.
Yeah, when she did. She got everything.
She got everything. And I know when you talk about control, the person who got all of that was this face. And I'm with you. I hope that if indeed Don is convicted, that the prosecution jumps to Wendy. I think that's their plan.
I hope so.
But if she's not convicted, I don't think they'll do it.
There's one other thing that I will add is Wendy's a lawyer and she knows really good lawyers. She's not going to have a defense attorney like this. So it will be harder. I would like them to charge her. I would like them to convict her. It will be a much more difficult case than all of the other ones that came before it. So I'll leave it at that.
Yep. Great. I am going to get you up on this stage so everybody can see you all by yourself. You are amazing. There is almost no one I know that knows this case better. And then you combine that with your background in psychology, in philosophy. I really appreciate you being here. You provide not only all the facts, and then you make it make sense from a sort of psychological perspective of those dynamics. So thank you so much. And Gypsy
thank
Rose,
you.
That's the other one. The next time we do a show on Gypsy Rose, I'm definitely going to be calling you back. And I can't thank you enough for your time.
Thank you so much. I always love it. I enjoy it. I will be a friend of the show forever. So thank you, Jen.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Everyone, oh my gosh, Dr. Eprite, she is a professor at Furman at University of South Carolina, another one that has Ivy League credentials in study. She's just amazing. And she's a true crimer too. She's a trial watcher. She's somebody who really has a passion for these cases. And I just find her fascinating. And anyway, I want to thank the mods today. And if you guys enjoyed the show, and I know we went longer than we normally ever go, but I appreciate y'all being here. And if you like the show, I hope you subscribe. I hope you come back again and like the show. All right, everyone. Until next time, enjoy your Sunday and may justice be served for Donna Adelson and Wendy down the road.
Want to break the case with Jennifer Coffendaffer even more? Then press subscribe right now and join Jen on YouTube. Just search Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer now.